This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest poet has come training in from New York, Matthew Hittinger, and he's come just to read us a poem. How good is that? So let's hear an opening poem, Matthew Hittinger.
Orange-colored sky. And not just because it's my favorite color, but when Diana Prince spins, her nimbus fills me with glee and glow. And when I was a boy, I wore my mother's high heels and wrapped my binky around my neck like a cape, and then coiled it at my side, my blanket of truth. And I spun and spun, arms outstretched, and wanted that light to fill me, envelop me, the way I saw it change Linda Carter on TV. And one time she was the guest on The Muppet Show, and I clicked around the basement rec room, kicking open the doors to the other side, as we called it, where my father's workbench and the furnace, where my brother set up his D&D figurine painting table, where each Christmas we'd raise the train platform, and where forgotten furniture loomed in half shadows. Through here, I kicked. Flash, kick bam, kick alakazam, double kick. For in heels, I could deflect the shadows like bullets, my wrists wondrous. And when I returned from the other side to the rec room's wood panels and lamp shades, this leaning toward became learning toward, and I would sit, visible to all, as I piloted an invisible jet through the orange sky.
That is the voice of Matthew Hittinger. And what book is that from?
That's from Skin Shift.
How do you describe that book?
Skin Shift is obsessed with mythology, in particular metamorphosis myths. So I set out to collect transformation myths from around the world beyond the ones we all know from Greek mythology. So there is a sequence retelling the Narcissus and Echo myth called Narcissus Resists, which gets the Greek myths in there. But then I tried to get other, so like an Aboriginal myth about the woman who turned into a kangaroo.
And did you Russian bring them myth. Up to present day?
I did.
And make
so
analogies?
That was the fun, kind of seeing how which myths still resonated in the contemporary world and how you could take details and kind of update them. So if like a woman's looking for earthworms under a stone in the original story, it could be her buying gummy worms from a 7-Eleven.
Oh, Matthew Hittinger, I'm so glad you came to us. We just needed some magic today. And he is the author of many books besides Skin Shift. We just heard a poem which inaugurated the program, and that won him a 2012 debut poet from Poets and Writers magazine, which is pretty competitive. After that, he has three chapbooks, including Pear Slip, which won Aspire Press Award. Then he was shortlisted for the National Poetry Series, the New Issues Poetry Prize, and twice for the Walt Whitman Award. He has received the Hopwood Award, the Helen S. and John Wagner Prize from the University of Michigan. I'm exhausted from your awards, but I'm going to go soldier on.
Okay.
The K. Dieter Award from the journal Fine Madness, 2 Sundress Best of the Net nominations, and 11 Pushcart Prize. How do you explain this?
All the awards?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny that you found all that because I don't even put that stuff much in my bio anymore.
But it is impressive. Because you're a young poet.
Doesn't feel that way on this end, but
I know.
It's hard when you're in it, you know.
And also, in the middle of the night, the trophy doesn't feel so warm and cuddly.
All the second guessing that happens at 3 in the morning. Yeah.
Matthew Hittinger is here, and I'd like you to tell us one thing before you read another poem.
Sure.
And that is, how do you think you describe your poetry so that it is yours and could not be anyone else's?
There's something about the way I visually construct a poem on the page that when I look at my work, just visually it looks like a Matthew Hittinger poem to me. The placement, because rarely will you find the work all left justified. It really spreads out across the page. At the most extreme would be the calligram, because being someone who has roots in the visual arts, I like to create poems that make shapes out of things. One tends to pop up per book, sometimes two in more recent manuscripts. But there's a sculptural quality to the way the words cascade down the page that, to me, it's when I look at a work in the drafting stage, there's a point where I'm like, it doesn't visually look like a me poem yet.
So the aesthetics on the page, and you are an artist as well, and a printmaker, and now those things are all coming together in your life at the moment.
They are, yes.
But now you're a poet for us, and please do read a poem.
Okay. So I'm going to turn to my newest book, The Mask of Marilyn.
Who was that publisher?
Didi Menendez, Goss 183. Didi you might know from magazines such as Mi Poesias and Poets Artists.
She is, I feel, the greatest curator of art in our century.
Super generous.
Let's hear a poem.
All right. And this is in the voice of Marilyn Monroe. In pursuit of a more perfect armor. In pursuit of a more stable form, I knelt, displayed a more perfect armor that began with my name in lore minorma, where I orphaned the letters that could not contain the golden dream. I was to blame. I reigned over a golden age, a golden theme. In my norma role, I was Miss Golden Dreams. I was the girl next door, a honey shade. To get skin this cream, first block burnt umber. Use that honey shade to define flesh and bone until you whip that crazed scream called men's minds. While in my mind, it was always scarlet, velvet, and gold. You see, my nudity was the brightest armor I could don. But I found another armor in my mole, another eye I felt inside me, beside the alien ocean, under the mineral sky. This other I, this twin, this self, I brought this self into being. For in pursuit of a more stable form, in pursuit of this other I, the I of my amour, of my true armor, I destroyed the armor of mime only and built my body, colored block by colored block, until I gleamed beyond that golden dream. Your golden beauty queen, so bright I burn right off your TV, laptop, movie screen. I am your armored beam, my breastplate silver with golden seams. The light kneels before my knuckles, my cheek. The light kneels before me. Oil my armor, men. All the available light swallowed into me, into this eye, the opposite of a black hole. This eye absorbs all the light and gives it back a thousandfold. A bright diamond, a light to call best friend, conjured in the mirror, both your standard and your sword. Until I am Marilyn no more.
Matthew Hittinger, that's a work of art to transform her that way and to use the mole as the light that kneels before her. What is your fascination with Marilyn?
We have the same birthday, June 1st, which was something I always knew, but a friend of mine, the great poet Jessica Smith, pointed it out a few years ago and reminded me of this and sent me Joyce Carol Oates' Blonde.
Yes.
Which I read that summer, and it just set my imagination going. And a lot of books have come out in recent years investigating the more serious literary.
Do you think you were trying to vindicate her?
Yes. I think she was a very smart woman and that people don't give enough credit to. And a lot has come out of her unpublished writings and poems. And she was an avid reader. She was smart. And, you know, she created a character, you know, the girl.
This book is called what?
The Mask of Marilyn.
And why the mask?
Because Marilyn was a mask. I mean, it was an identity she created. Mm-hmm. And as she got along in life, it became harder and harder to conjure Marilyn. There's reports about how long it would take to working with her makeup artist to bring Marilyn to the surface. You know, there were times where she would have him just scrub off all the makeup and start from scratch because it just wasn't there. And it became harder and harder to conjure her up.
And you have conjured her up in a way which will make her immortal.
Yeah.
And now she'll never die.
Yeah.
She must be very grateful. Let's have another poem.
Sure.
Matthew Hittinger at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is another dramatic monologue from the book in the voice of Marlene Dietrich, who's another love of mine. And there's it's from a night when I was really interested in the year Marilyn disappeared from Hollywood in 1955, 56, where she went to New York to become a serious actress, to study at the Actors Studio. And there's an interesting story. She kind of hid from the media and ran off to New York wearing a black wig and calling herself Zelda Zonks, and I think she hid out in the trunk of Milton Green's car to avoid the paparazzi, and then had a big unveiling in January of that year of Marilyn Monroe Productions. So this is a scene from that night that it was a little moment in a bio, just a line that I read that sparked this poem. And it's a villanelle, which was one of my favorite forms.
And this is in the voice of Marlene Dietrich.
Yes.
Okay.
I am not a myth. Marlene Dietrich remembers the night of the Marilyn Monroe Productions press conference, New York City, January 1955. I wanted to be that trace of scarlet lipstick when you arrived, tipsy, a bit chartreuse, a subdued platinum angel, a white mink stole. I am at heart, come up for a drink, a gentleman. You, a question here to seduce, a pink thought traced by scarlet lipstick, a deer drawn to a salt lick. I am the brick back, brick throne widow of a caboose. I lift my black veil. I drop my black mink. To the bird flown, we toast with a clink. You created the girl. Their golden goose is now a scarlet smudge. Your lips stick to the wine glass, and all I can do is wink out a song, the tricks of an aging chanteuse. You call a cab and grab your white mink while I play my saw, and all I can think is, I am not a myth, a recluse who will recuse you to remain a trace of scarlet lipstick caught on the collar of a white mink.
Do you believe Marlene Dietrich then was handing her the baton?
Yes, I think Marilyn got her dressing room at the studio, if I remember correctly.
And so that poem is about aging, mm-hmm. and it's about the next generation of sparkle and lipstick. And let's hear more.
Sure.
This is Marilyn Monroe's Mask, but what's the title?
The Mask of Marilyn.
The Mask of Marilyn.
Because it's also, I mean, the double meaning of, it's mask, kind of like the performance, M-A-S-Q-U-E, where there's a cast, there's a lot of dramatic monologues in here. And the rule was they had to have the letter M in their name, like first or last initial, in order to be in here. So we've got Marlena, we have Mae West, who's I'm going to read in a few minutes, Montgomery Clift.
And you did that to carry forth the theme of the big M.
Yeah, and sometimes when you're looking at a subject like Marilyn, where there's who's so well known, you have to come at it from different angles. You kind of have to refract it and have other voices talk about the subject.
You have my greatest admiration for taking icon and making it brand new.
Oh, thank you.
And let's go on. Matthew right. Hittinger at the Library of Congress.
So there's a series of poems in the Marilyn book that take place at the Museum of the Moving Image, which is in my neighborhood in Astoria, Queens. And Marilyn pops up in some of them, and some of them, it's just a contrast to constantly being in Marilyn's voice or in Marilyn's world in the book. So this one's just a fun one. There's an animation studio where you can record yourself doing something for 20 seconds and then make a little flip book out of it. Video flip book. One word or 1,000 for a still image in a frame, and for 20 camera seconds, 40 pages, none the same, but similar enough that when flipped are like a game. You and I stand back to back and raise our hands like guns. We cock and turn and crack, steepled index and thumb. Charlie's Angels, we attack. We grin and soon succumb to half a laugh, half in sync, to have a wink frozen in ink.
That is a flicker. It is. Matthew Hittinger was born and raised in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And he got his BA in art history and English from Muhlenberg, and then his master's of fine arts in creative writing from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And since then, he has gone on to study printmaking. And so we'll go on with one poem, and then we will explore who you are.
All right. This is another from the Museum of the Moving Image, Model Magic Mirror. Not the clay with which I used to play, sculpting colorful wee creatures with a palm rub or tuck, but a mirror that makes my head appear, severed to float over white halter, white skirt, that famous hip halo. Did you know at the fresh age of 18, I once answered a casting call for a runway show? The director's Chia Pet Green Coif asked, after Slink Shadow Walk and T-Pose Vogue, if I could sing Happy Birthday in one of two styles, Sinatra or Monroe.
Hmm.
If Sinatra to her, if Monroe to her beau, and I, not knowing Sinatra's rage range or bass bellow in my bones, went to that white hot place called blonde that glows over my stomach. That's model magic. As I stand here, superimposing us with a knob and dial, turned to match this body to my head, all ambition, sequin sought, and wet lip glitz. And for a minute, that assistant was my president. And the white and pink snakeskin suit I wore the day of the show was door and corridor. I conjure her body here, but not her face. Oh, magic mirror, in your final years, how many takes to make M cohere?
Let's hear that last line again.
Oh, magic mirror, in your final years, how many takes to make M cohere?
Yes, because she was so splintered, right?
Yeah.
You are pretty much an authority on her, I guess, as much as anyone. And tell me, what is the one time in her life you thought she was happy?
Oh.
You've read her biography.
Many biographies.
And don't you think that she was on the verge of happiness, like, almost all the time? Do you think it was when she was married to, well, let's take a husband.
Joe Arthur Miller.
How about Arthur Miller? Do you think she had a moment where she felt safe with him?
I think early on. I don't know. It's so hard. There's so many competing stories of her life and theories as to, you know, was it the fact that she couldn't have children because of the endometriosis? That, and then the biggest betrayal with Miller was, I think the way it's told is he had written stuff about her in his diary or journals. This is when they were in London and she was shooting The Prince and the Showgirl, I think. And that, I think that was the biggest betrayal, to find like what he had written about her in his own notebook. Complicated with the fact that, you know, the failed pregnancies and...
What do you think was her moment where she felt who she was? Some Like It Hot? Was that her film?
Yeah, Some Like It Hot. That's a great
film.
Wasn't
she at her best then?
That was like sort of a resurgence later in her life where she kind of came back.
Oh.
I think where people are like, oh, she's returning to form.
Oh, I see.
I think she was a comedic genius. I think that playing the dumb blonde, she wasn't, I mean, you look at those films and you rewatch them and it's like, oh, she's a smart cookie. She knows exactly what she's doing.
Well, I think that you are doing something very important because you're shining a whole different light on her and approaching it from a way only a poet can do. And so please do it.
Sure.
Matthew Hittinger.
This one's in the voice of Mae West, talking about refracting famous blonde actresses across the history of Hollywood.
Was she still alive?
Yes.
Oh.
She was. And that's where this account comes from. I've got nothing on but the radio. Mae West observes Marilyn Monroe's final photo shoot, Santa Monica Beach, July 1962. I don't know what drew me to the beach that day, but I saw her, or myself. It's so hard to know if she is me or I her, if I see the past where the waves touch her feet, or the now under the shadow of a wide-brimmed straw hat. I could not move. I could not speak. Pillar or caryatid, I heard speech. I am your destiny. Reach me over that beach. But I could not tell if I said the words or if she, if her blonde surf was the wind's blonde laugh, sand in my teeth, the grit of come up and see me sometime, the line we both used. It's not true I had nothing on. I had the radio on. I've got nothing on but the radio. And I'm still listening for her voice in the static.
That's a great line. I have nothing on but the radio.
Yeah,
yeah, they were so different in temperament, though.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah. Go on with this. You've got us now.
Yeah? More?
I do want to know this.
Yeah.
If gender defines us,
sure.
Then she was a prisoner of gender, wasn't she? Because she had to be the epitome of the female.
Mm.
And she was. It was a prison, really, for her.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't falter for a moment. It had to be the brightest pink, the blondest blonde,
right.
The satinest satin.
Yep.
And what do you have to say about that?
Being a prisoner of gender?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh.
I think it's a shame.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's tricky because it's like the thing that you realize is your greatest strength sometimes in terms of using it to your advantage to get what you want from the world or to get ahead. But in her case, you know, is an exaggerated femininity, you know? There was an account where she would, I don't know if it's true or not, but would have so much of one of her heels cut off to create the wobble when she walked.
I love yeah. it. Tell us more like that.
Oh, gosh.
And how about the skirt up in the air? I guess that will be the icon for the
yeah.
century, won't it?
You know, that's interesting, too. They had to reshoot that scene in the studio.
To get her skirt to go up?
Well, because when they did it on the street, it created such a frenzy of men crowding around, and DiMaggio was not too pleased at the time.
Oh, yes.
And she had to... I think she had to wear two layers of underwear so that nothing would... I mean, it was very...
Not like the crotch shots we get on television every night. Okay.
Right.
This is Matthew Hittinger, who has elevated Marilyn to this place where she should have been all along. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And name the book again.
The Mask of Marilyn.
And say it to us.
This next poem is Tut's Fever Palace, which... is another at the Museum of the Moving Image poem. It's an actual reconstruction of an old movie viewing house it's in the middle of the museum, and you can go in, and it's decked out, and it's totally garish and kind of rococo, and it's murals, and it'll be alluded to in here. It's really fun, though, and the museum rotates what plays in there. They have little showings every so many minutes throughout the day. Tut's Fever Palace. Before the Mummy movie franchise, The Scorpion King, the Hollywood Monster Mash Rogue Gallery linchpin, I constructed my own sarcophagus. Same age as Tutankhaten, the gaunt school project days, below weight boy forced to take applesauce smashed pills to stimulate frame gain, piano long fingers cut four cardboard sides, base glued, painted gold, the same gold paint I would later use to transform Castle Gray to Gold Skull. No flesh-eating stone, but a crypt for plastic. My brother and I found a discarded Barbie in the toy chest, sheared off her blonde locks, filed her breasts flat. I mixed a bowl of flour and water, mixed so many times before. Papier-mâché newspaper strips over chicken wire to build mountains for Lego castles. This time, to wrap gauze swatches around orange skin. I chin-affixed a pointed false beard and slid shut the cold, giant Horus eyelid. Miniature version to this camel pack wink. Pull here. James Dean pops open, lip dangling sig, Egyptian chic. An odd thing, like the Austin Motel's room 129 decked out with hieroglyphs. Steely funerary statues, sphinx pics, a silver circle inscribed Troy on the lobby cat's collar, our terracotta Helen of Egypt, turquoise stencil trim, papyrus lotus reed, all symbol and restrained deco, unlike the rococo mural noise in this palace. The curtains part, lights dim, projector click, a screen beam at the pyramid peak, the Muppet Show or a Green Hornet episode, modern glow echoes the Giza 3, white, red, and black, ancient Nile, Tesla Tower batteries. And when we leave, the Marilyn Caryatid Grieve greets us, one hand pressing knee down her angel wing skirt as the fingers of her other lift the lintel marquee, a cobra crown, a scarab gown, an owl, the mascara of the Sphinx's growl.
Matthew Hittinger, may we have a closing poem?
Sure. I'm going to turn to my book, The Erotic Postulate. So this is, I like to call it my little treatise on love. Two ones remain two ones. That is the problem, is it not? The problem with love. the fact that two ones remain two ones. Hedvig sings Origin of Love through my stereo. Of course, her story's complicated, that botched sex op for one. But she rehearses Aristophanes, his story, love's structure argued. Woman-woman, woman-man, man-man. Are we all like pieces of the coins that children break into half for keepsakes? I know nothing of breaking or having. Flip the coin. Make two spin out of one. Motion multiplies the eye. We are not like the flat fish. No, they want nothing more than to remain flat pleuronectiforms, blend into seafloor. Fact, they swim on their sides, eyes cast heaven wide. Does that mean lack, that they are but half? If each of us forever seeks the half that will tally with himself, should we not first tally with him and then self? Tally one plus one. A two comprised of two ones does not contain two ones. Onione does not mean two, nor Ionion, nor Inune. Scramble the letters. Ask what is new about love after eons. Slippery words stretched, forced to contain ones, twos, and more twos. Lufu, Lubiati, roots that fill, fulfill too. If I am complete in myself, and you are complete in yours, why come together? It takes two to love, to know how to separate, how to come, Erigere writes, back together. It takes ions, two stable, unstable ones, to reach union. But do two same-sex ones differ? Same a misnomer? There is no difference. Go towards that which enables becoming. I do not love you. I love to you, toward you, the way one December morning thunder pressed my thoughts toward Philly's art museum, that painting were a bolt of light toward canvas, toward you the way back pressed against back one creature slept beneath a blanket and sheet, the way you then stirred, spooned me, slid one arm under my shoulder, one leg between my thighs, as rain syncopated the roof's slate, a staccato hold on a legato undertow, the gutters running over, the way wind muttered in the shutters, the way a curious trimeter tinkling tore us from bed, wet ceiling seams split as I groped the attic with a towel, bucket, and flashlight for wet spots, the way I paused, listened for your voice to yell, it stopped, come down, the way I crawled back under the covers, your body yours, my body mine, one next to one as two.
The voice of Matthew Hittinger. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional funding by Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue, and Candace Katz. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.